the public might instinctively feel that something is wrong. But because of the technical nature of the silent weapon, they cannot express their feeling in a rational way or handle the problem with intelligence. Therefore, they do not know how to cry for help and do not know how to associate with others to defend themselves against it.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. US President Donald Trump coming to London in July, but will he go home with his credibility intact? Elections in Lebanon this weekend and Turkey next month, both key players in the tug of war for Syria. How independent is Lebanon these days? Why has Erdogan decided to call an early election in Turkey? Can Turkey still really be in NATO whilst buying the most sophisticated anti-aircraft missiles, the S-400, from Moscow? And two of the biggest basket case states in the world, racist Israel and warmongering United States. We take a look tonight at these two governments that represent arguably thorns in the side of humanity. Both make a lot of fuss about being democracies, but are they really oligarchies where the rich and powerful vet all the possible candidates and the press decide for the people who they want them to vote for? And as Trump finally gets permission to come to Britain on the 13th of July, Washington is still seen as the world's policeman. But is it a corrupt policeman? Over the instigators of almost all the wars since the Second World War, what motivates them? And with the announcement today that Britain is spearheading an attempt to overthrow Putin through diplomatic means, thankfully not military yet, what about Britain, who created those two basket case countries? Are we too still major players in the conspiracy to undermine the United Nations Security Council? How realistic are calls for Russia to be kicked out of the UN Security Council? Our sister show Dialect's been online only for the past 7 weeks due to mysterious technical problems which BCFM management and technical people are looking into. We should be on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday, but you can catch it on YouTube or online at dialectradio.co.uk. This week, Bristol-based psychedelic rock band The Transpersonals have a new album out. We hear from lead singer Tim Herford, and then to Truro and inventor Andrew Tweedy, who's concerned about organophosphate fertilizers, pesticides, and has been working out in the Pacific Islands too, installing his unique desalination plants. Finally, we hear about our regular correspondent, born in Dresden, Germany, who worked on computer systems at Switzerland's CERN particle accelerator. She's now retired and editing the victimsunite.net website about miscarriages of justice. She's Sabine McNeil, but she's been blowing the whistle on child sexual abuse. So how has she herself ended up in jail? That's Dialect on BCFM at noon next Tuesday, or you can download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But first of all, Martin, we've got elections in Lebanon. Can you just give us a bit of the background? I've lost count of the number of times that Israel has invaded Lebanon. I think it's something like 7 or 8 times since the end of the Second World War.
As an invasion, they've certainly been interfering in Lebanese politics directly and indirectly, including the...
I'm talking about IDF boots on the ground.
Yeah, well, they invaded in 1982. Lebanon is a very fragile, multi-ethnic, democratic state, which requires very careful negotiations between the different communities to prevent the return to the civil war that devastated the country in the 1970s and early 1980s.
But was that civil war, was it a bit like the Syrian civil war? Were there outside actors?
Well, yes, of course. Yeah, there were outside actors as well.
Who were they then?
Well, essentially, the Israelis were major players. They supported the Christian phalangists at that time. And the West tended to support the same forces. You've got the largest single community is a Sunni community, so in that sense it's very similar to Syria. But the most deprived community is the Shia community, and they, of course, are pretty much represented by Hezbollah. And Hezbollah have been part of the government of Lebanon for some time now.
But it's the first election since nearly a decade, since 2009, yeah. And they're also trialling a proportional representation vote system.
Yeah, well, I mean, as I say, it's a very delicate situation. One of the positive things about Lebanon is that Michel Aoun, who is the president of Lebanon, is a Christian, and he's a very close ally of Hezbollah, who are Shia. And they were in the civil war. They were on opposite sides. So the fact that they've now developed a very collaborative relationship just shows that over time things can change and people's attitudes can change. And you know, the Lebanese in general do not want to be in the situation that Syria's ended up in. And of course, lots of refugees from Syria have ended up in Lebanon.
One of the difficulties in Lebanon is that so much of the country's infrastructure is now being privatised. There was a big strike over bin collections. This sort of thing is going on all the time over there. How much does it denude the quality of election when the government is actually not responsible for that much anymore? Most of their infrastructure has been outsourced.
Well, they never were responsible for that much in Lebanon. It's not so much that it's been privatised, it just was never there in the first place. Elections and politics in Lebanon, as I've tried to suggest, the real purpose of electoral politics and politics in general in Lebanon is to prevent a return to civil war. And in general, they've managed to do that. You've got two major coalitions, the sort of pro-Saudi coalition led by Hariri, who's actually partly Saudi, he's got Saudi citizenship, and then the opposition coalition, or the governing coalition, as has been, which is Aoun and the Hezbollah. But they've kind of agreed power sharing, and the constitution of Lebanon is very intricate. You know, you've got to have a Christian president. The president, I think, has got to be a Christian. The leader of the parliament has to be a Shia. The prime minister has to be a Sunni. And this is all part of the constitution that was evolved as a result of the civil war to make sure that everybody had a fair crack of the whip.
I mean,
it's quite rickety, obviously.
To what extent do you think the people, the ruling class in Lebanon, have got a really independent view? Because that part of the world is so contested right now. It's incredibly contested.
Well, I think you'll find
outside powers are surely, you know, really, really trying to control. Everyone is trying to control what happens there.
Well, I mean, the Israelis routinely cross into Lebanese airspace to carry out attacks on Syrian positions, which, of course, is completely illegal, and the Lebanese are furious about it. But I think one of the interesting things that's happened is that the Christian community in Lebanon, who used to see Israel as their ally, now are aligned with the rest of the Lebanese people in seeing Israel as the major enemy of the country. And the Lebanese army basically trains to fight Israel and cooperates quite closely with Hezbollah. And that is a big change from the 70s and 80s, when the Christians were very much a kind of fifth column for Israel inside Lebanon. That's all gone.
Okay, let's have a look at Turkey then. Why has Erdogan called this snap general election for next month?
Because what he wants to do is change the constitution to give the president more powers, parliament less powers, and basically, you know, enhance his own position.
It's a power grab, is it?
It's a power grab, essentially, yeah.
So, I mean, is that why the Western press is saying, oh gosh, this is could be the end of democracy, this election?
Well, you've got to recognise that Erdogan does have big popular support in certain parts of Turkey. In the Sunni dominated western part of Turkey, he's got big popular support. And of course the attempt to remove him by the coup, which most Turks believe was carried out by the Americans, has consolidated his position. I mean, several hundred people died in that coup. It wasn't bloodless. And you can imagine the Turks are pretty fed up about that. And they're determined to vote for people who are opposed to that kind of policy. But of course, the Kurdish question hasn't been resolved. In the eastern part of Turkey, you've got 20 million odd people who are Kurdish origin, and they are implacably opposed to Erdogan's power grab. And of course, what happened before this latest round of crisis was he tried this on, and of course the HDP, which is the Kurdish party, but they've got a wider appeal than that. They've got a leftist appeal to non-Kurds. Thwarted him by getting 14% of the vote, and therefore winning enough seats in parliament to prevent him changing the constitution. I presume what he's hoping with this election is that he will get enough votes to change the constitution to make it a presidential system.
I mean, is this really the US-led coup backfiring?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, definitely. You can see that Erdogan lost his temper. Turkey is now turning into a swing state where it's not quite clear where their loyalties lie. And if you think about it, if you're a country like Turkey, a bit like Egypt in the 1950s, you want to play the big powers off against each other. So when the Americans start to bully you, you get cozy with the Russians, and when the Russians do things you don't like, you turn back to the Americans. Of course, that does lead to a situation where very few people trust Erdogan, because of course it was his son Bilal Erdogan who was accused by the Russians of being a major beneficiary of ISIS oil sales. And of course at that time the CIA and MI6 were quite happy with what Erdogan was doing, because they were supporting ISIS, but they were allowing the Turks to do it for them with money provided by Saudi Arabia, etc. But I mean, that's, these are big power politics, and this is a very dangerous region.
Okay, on election time, before we go on to talk about Armenia, just briefly, is Turkey really in NATO?
Yes, for now.
So when these Russian missiles arrive, are the Americans and the British going to look at them and pull them apart?
Well, no, the Congress in the US has said that if Erdogan buys these missiles, there's a question of whether he should be allowed, he should be punished in some way for doing this. Personally, if I was the Russians, I wouldn't sell Erdogan this 400, but there you go. They're also talking about selling them to Saudi Arabia, which I think is completely bonkers. But there you go.
Why is Turkey considering this? Surely they would normally just be buying them from Raytheon or the Central.
Well, because what it implies,
American contractor.
After the coup, what it implies is that we might have to fight the Americans, so we want something to shoot their planes down with. It may be after he's won this election, which he probably will, he'll kick the Americans out of Incirlik. Yeah? Because that's what he can do if he wants to. And in fact, the Americans have got nuclear weapons in Incirlik. And at one stage, Erdogan was talking about just surrounding Incirlik and taking those nuclear weapons.
Well, they cut the power supply off to it, didn't they, during the coup attempt?
I mean, most people in this country are blissfully unaware of how close we are to a major Middle East war, which will drag us in, even though many fools were cheerleading for the stupid provocation that we engaged in bombing Syria from Akrotiri the other week. They're lucky that it didn't set off an explosion, but next time it might, and then we're all in for it.
Now, in the background to all of this is the evil Putin, of course, and we've just heard today that Britain is going to build a anti-Russia alliance, Britain's shock aim to end Putin's power. This is the Daily Express today. Britain's plotting to build an anti-Russian alliance will use major upcoming international summits to persuade its allies to form a plan to crush Putin's power in Moscow. The four summits that are going to be doing this is the G20 in Argentina, the G7 in Canada, and the NATO and EU summits coming up this summer. Martin, are they going to be successful in doing that? And why is it that Russia is seen to be the enemy here?
Well, they're not going to remove Putin. That's just a lot of talk. His position is frankly unassailable in terms of Russian politics.
Well, this is to do with the poisoning, surely.
Well, no, it's not. It's to do with all sorts of things.
Salisbury.
Yes, and it's also to do with the shooting down of MH17, the taking of Crimea, you name it. The Russians are guilty of it. Fixing elections, apparently, and all the rest of it. They want, they need Russia as an enemy. The military-industrial complex in the West needs a major enemy so that they can spend massive amounts of taxpayers' money on their own boondoggles, you know, to keep them all in the style to which they'd become accustomed. So, of course, Theresa May's husband, Philip May, made a killing, literally, on the missile attacks on Syria. His shares that he owned have gone up in value. This is why they need an enemy, and Russia provides, you know, Al-Qaeda is just not sufficient.
I think it was one of the most senior...
Of course, Al-Qaeda isn't really our enemy as well.
I think it was one of the most senior ever US CIA officers who decided to go public and write a book, John Stockwell, that wrote a book, In Search of Enemies. And actually, quite a lot at the time, it does seem like the Western powers NATO are just desperate to find somebody else to have a go.
They have
had
to have an enemy.
Saddam Hussein. We've had President Gaddafi of Libya, and we've also had Assad in Syria. Putin, I suppose, is almost the ultimate bad guy.
He is, from their point of view, because what he's doing is defending Russian national interests in a robust fashion, unlike Boris Yeltsin, for example, who's very well remembered in Russia, although almost forgotten here, when the country was absolutely looted by business interests, internal and external, and the living standards of the population collapsed. They've gradually improved under Putin's stewardship. He's massively popular in Russia, far more popular than mainstream politicians in the West. Neither Trump nor Theresa May has got anything like the electoral clout of somebody like Putin.
Or Assad, come to that.
Or Assad, yeah. Or Assad. And the fact is that they need an enemy, and therefore, you know, Russia's providing that enemy. But of course, what they may do is overcook this and end up with a war with Russia, which, if you look at it objectively, the Russians will win. Because we haven't got a strategy. They don't know what they're doing. They're blundering around. It's a good job that the Russians don't want a war with us, because if they were to decide to pick up the gauntlet, then we'd already be in the middle of it.
Martin, they do have a strategy, and it's announced in today's Daily Express. The Prime Minister Theresa May said the incident in Salisbury was a state-sponsored attempted murder after evidence showed that the ex-spy and his daughter had been attacked using a military-grade nerve agent of a type developed by Russia.
Yes, well, I mean, it's transpired in the last 24 hours that the Czechs also developed Novichok, and I was nearly on Russia Today talking about this last night, but they phoned me too late and I couldn't do it. The fact is that both chemical weapons attacks, supposed chemical weapons attacks, have been virtually comprehensively debunked. And as the Russians were pointing out today, the OPCW says that something like 50 to 100 grams of Novichok was used, and they were very vague about how much. And they also said that they'd found Novichok on the door handle, on the bench. On the bench! How did it get on the bench? How did they know that they were going to go to that bench? And the whole story has unravelled, frankly.
Well, I'll tell you what. What about the actual Novichok itself? Because there is a Swiss lab, apparently, that's cast aspersions on whether there was any Novichok there at all.
That's
and
right.
Also, this may explain why this incredibly deadly nerve agent, which can kill you literally within minutes, a tiny speck of the stuff, actually there were three people that were contaminated with it, and all, it looks like, have survived.
Well, indeed, the whole thing looks very suspicious. And as I've pointed out in the past, Western intelligence services are quite capable of faking these kind of events. What seems to have happened in Douma is that the White Helmets, who are funded by you folks, the British taxpayer funds the White Helmets. You didn't know that, did you? But we do. And they were told to stage a video of a chemical weapons attack. And the Russians took various people from the hospital to Geneva about 10 days ago to testify, to say that the whole thing was a hoax. And it was a hoax not just done by the rebels of Jaish al-Islam, but also coordinated with the Western intelligence.
Sorry, you call them the rebels. The BBC call them the rebels. I call them the terrorists.
Well, let's call them Jaish al-Islam. Al-Qaeda. And they are actually didn't do it on their own. They did it that both, in my humble opinion, both Salisbury and Douma were orchestrated psychological warfare operations by our own MI6. Both of them.
Okay, so how is Britain going to end Putin's power as they've announced
they're
today?
Not going to. What they're going to do is they're going to try and isolate Russia and therefore, for example, prevent... What they'd love to happen is for the Germans to renege on the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. That's what the Americans want. They want to sell their more expensive fracked gas to Europe rather than the cheaper Russian gas. And that would be the goal they're going for. Immediately, if they can get it, but of course the German industrialists aren't happy with that. But of course they're being bullied into line by the British. But of course, being the British leaving the European Union, they're going to have less influence over the Germans than they might.
So, Martin, what is really behind this then? Why is Britain trying, if what you're saying is correct, to deliberately pick a fight with a nuclear armed superpower?
Because we are poodles of the United States of America, who are poodles of the Israelis, etc. We are just small players in a bigger game. And the idea of keeping a war economy going, that's all we do in this country, really. We don't produce a better widget. The only serious high tech we do is military, and therefore keeping up military spending is very important for the future pension prospects of many people in the government who when they retire are going to be sitting on the boards of all these companies which are getting taxpayer money to make weaponry. But of course the problem with arms races, which are only supposed to be basically for money, is that you end up having a war with all the weaponry that you've created, and there's no strategy there at all. Because in actual fact, the Russians, as Putin pointed out in his big speech before he was elected, they now have a decisive advantage, partly because they've only got a defensive posture. The problem for the United States of America, with its 108 bases all over the world, is they're spread too thin. The Russians just concentrate on what they need to do and make sure they do it right.
Okay, and what's the press's role in all this? You mentioned just briefly Russia Today there. Overall, we don't seem to be getting enough questioning of what the press is being told by the government. I suppose it's a fairly simple thing to keep the press so that most of what they do is supporting the government. After all, the government is democratically elected.
Well, yes, and don't forget, most of the press, apart from the public sector part of the press, is owned by billionaires who've got a vested interest in the arms industry and all the rest of it. Rupert Murdoch is another great beneficiary of the military-industrial complex.
Well, also, most of these, if not all of them, apart from, I guess, the BBC, have much of their wealth in tax havens as well.
Indeed, and the BBC is... just like Russia Today, a creature of the government. It's not entirely controlled by the government, but there's definitely a limit they're not going to overstep. And you could argue that Russia Today has a very similar remit to the BBC. It's not entirely independent, but it's more independent than the private sector. The private sector really is. I mean, if you look at the Daily Mail or the Daily Express, which is owned by... what was his name?
Richard Desmond.
Richard Desmond. These people are wealthy, opinionated, wealthy people.
It's now been bought up by Trinity Mirror, who owns our local paper here.
Indeed. But the point is, it's still keeping the editorial policy it used to have. And most of the press in the West, as used to be the case in Russia during the Bezpredel era, is controlled by oligarchs who've got a vested interest in filling their people's heads with nonsense. I mean, if you read The Sun every day for a lifetime, you are going to get a very distorted view of the world. And that's not an accident. That's quite deliberate. Rupert Murdoch is not just somebody who likes to make money. He wants to form opinions, and he's got political ambitions of a very reactionary kind. What people consume day in, day out.
In any kind of free society, there are also all sorts of other discussions, including things like on social media. But one event which is happening soon, or was going to be happening soon, I think it was the 27th of May, is an event that has been run so far down in Frome in Somerset and in London, and it's called The Media on Trial, where various people involved in these conflicts and freelance journalists discuss, including Vanessa Bealey, who's the daughter of the former British ambassador to Egypt, who was ridiculed, as we covered last week on the BBC World Service. And there is this event coming up in Leeds, a controversial, but this is the Yorkshire Post today, a controversial Leeds Museum event featuring pro-Assad speakers who question Western reporting of chemical weapons attack in Syria has been cancelled. So it's been cancelled by Leeds City Council, apparently. Media on Trial event was due to take place at Leeds City Museum on the 27th of May, but the council said after concerns were raised about some of the speakers, officials decided it was not an appropriate venue for this event.
So, that's so much for freedom of speech in our free country, eh?
The panel was due to discuss the media's propensity to either embed its journalists with terrorist forces or disseminate materials directly from terrorist sources.
Well, that's right. But thank goodness that the city fathers of Leeds have seen fit to prevent this poison being poured into the minds of the innocent, and they can just get their news every night from the BBC. Rah, 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 we're all going to war, Putin's the enemy.
Amongst those due to take part were Patrick Henningsen, editor and founder of the 21st Century Wire website, which has carried articles questioning whether forces loyal to the Syrian president Bashar Assad were responsible for the recent alleged chemical weapons attack in Douma.
Well, all the evidence suggests that they weren't. We've got eyewitnesses from the hospital, all of which have said that this was a staged video by the White Helmets, who then disappeared when the Jaish al-Islam were all allowed to leave the area. And anybody who looks at the independent media around the world knows that there was no incident. Incidentally, even if there had been an incident, there's no legal basis for the RAF to set off and bomb Syria.
Another speaker who has Leeds City Council have decided that they were not supposed to be allowed to hear is Peter Ford. He's a former British ambassador to Syria who's head of the controversial pro-Assad British Syrian Society.
Well, what does a former British ambassador to Syria have to say for himself?
And the daughter of a former...
Well, I mean, the problem with these people is that they're just too independent. And if we're going to have people questioning the government's line on things like this, well, what sort of society are we going to end up with? I think that everybody should just be made to do what the government thinks is right, and anybody who asks any questions, well, they should just be silenced. Surely that's the best policy.
We've got this, and we've also got social media as another possible place for these sorts of things to be discussed. In fact, various of those people there, particularly Patrick Henningsen at 21st Century Wire and Vanessa Bealey, they're very good people. I mean, you can find them on social media. They've got a tremendous number of followers. People obviously like listening to what they've got to say. But another one of those is the former ambassador, well, we've been talking about quite a lot of those today, Egypt, Syria and Uzbekistan, is the former Uzbekistan ambassador Craig Murray. He's been blocked by Facebook now, and his article is blocked by Facebook and the vulnerability of new media. What he says is that this website, that's his blog at craigmurray.org.uk, this site's visitor numbers are currently around one third of normal levels, stuck at around 20,000 unique visitors per day. The cause is not hard to find. Normally over half our visitors arrive via Facebook. These last few days virtually nothing has come from Facebook. So he actually then puts in a log from the website, the back end of the website, showing where all the visitors have come from to prove his point. He said it's what is especially pernicious is that Facebook deliberately imposes this censorship in a secretive way. The primary mechanism when a block is imposed is that my posts to Facebook, that's him, Craig Murray, are simply not sent into the timelines of the large majority of people who are friends or who follow. He's left to believe the post has been shared with them, but in fact it's only been seen by a tiny number.
Well, in other words, the mainstream media is being bullied into line to support war mongering policies, and the same thing is happening on social media.
And Twitter have a similar system, he says, known as shadow banning. Again, it's secretive and the victim is not informed. I do not appear to be shadow banned at the moment, but there's been an alarming, extremely sharp drop by a factor of 10 by the impressions my tweets are generating. Now, what this shadow banning means is that, for example, if you copy somebody in a tag on your Twitter account, say, for example, my Twitter tag is at Tony Gosling. If you put that in a tweet, normally it would be notified to that person that you've included them in a tweet so that they can see what's there. What's happening is certain accounts, now anybody that they tag in that tweet is not being notified, and Twitter haven't explained that to anybody.
Well, what's happening is there's a determined attempt by the deep state to close down debate about the policies that are being pursued, which suggests to me, Tony, and I've said this to you off air, that we're closer to a world war than people think. Because, of course, there's always a way round this stuff. You can't really stop people thinking and communicating. You can make it really difficult. And the only purpose of making it really difficult is because you intend to use psychological warfare methods in your war.
Well, they've used also demonetization.
Yeah.
YouTube, which happened for the first time around about 2.5 years ago. Luke Rutkowski, Luke We Are Change, his Twitter handle, at Luke We Are Change. He was one of the first people to report that, and he had been making his income from sticking his camera into the faces of the rich and powerful, and he got a fantastic audience as a result. But then they just said to him, well, you can't make any money out of these anymore because they're not advertiser-friendly. Of course, people then asked YouTube and Google. Google owns YouTube, saying, well, are you just providing YouTube videos for the advertisers, or are they for the users, or is the advertisers?
Well, it's the advertisers from the money point of view, isn't it? But it's not just that. These people are also in cahoots with the intelligence services, and there is a concerted attempt to silence people who they don't want to hear.
We heard from Michael Tyler a few months ago, his article at the beginning of the year about the what he called the Google War algorithm. So just over a space of a few days, a fantastic number of websites which were critical of the government narrative in one way or another just literally disappeared, including his own, disappeared off Google completely, and they only very slowly came back over several days. So, for example, you'd be searching for something which was on his website and it just simply had gone, and it was only these anti-war type websites that Google had disappeared from its search.
Yeah, and indeed, and before the 9/11 attacks, and we've obviously got a special coming up in a couple of weeks, various websites were taken down the day before. The websites that they knew would be critical, and they were taken down the day before. Do you think that was done from a cave in Afghanistan by Al-Qaeda? I don't think so. Do you?
Anyway, I'll put up a link to Craig Murray's very interesting, I think, very excellent explanation of what's happened to him and this whole shadow banning on Twitter. It just seems to me, Martin, that these big tech giants have got a virtual monopoly on these on social media now. They're realizing that people are turning more and more, particularly young people, there to get their news, and that is seen to be actually a threat to being able to dominate the narrative by the tech giants and by the mass media.
Well, it's a big struggle for us, isn't it? But I would suggest to anybody listening to this show, you're going to have to make more of an effort to find out the truth. You're going to have to make the same kind of effort we had before social media, where you really have to subscribe to certain journals. You've got to make bookmark everything you want to see.
Well, you can go to our page, a tab on the top of this show's page, which is called Diamonds in the Cesspool. And it's a way of looking at certain websites where if you want to get some alternative news, I mean, a lot of them have been called fake news websites, but for some reason, those websites are some of the best in the world, like globalresearch.ca, which is one of the only really good international analysis websites. And there's a whole list on there. So if you go to our show page at thisweek.org.uk, go to the top, you'll find a tab there saying Diamonds in the Cesspool, alternative news websites, and you can see a whole list there, including also search engines, because obviously people are starting to think it's not a good idea to be too reliant on Google. But Martin, I mean, in the mainstream press, there's been this assault as well. And I thought we'd have a listen now to something which had been going out on all US TV networks. I really found it quite shocking, and I don't think this would work in America, work in Britain, although it seems to work in the US, where all these US channels are being told that they've got to, people have got to beware of fake news, and every single station was using the same script. Do you think that sort of thing would work over here?
Well, no, because we're a smaller country and we don't have, it wouldn't be obvious over here what was going on in the same kind of way. I think what's interesting in the US, you've got all these different supposedly independent sources all coming out with the same script. which just shows that they're all puppets.
I am Fox San Antonio's Jessica Headley.
And I'm Ryan Wolf.
Our greatest responsibility is to serve our
Treasure Valley communities,
the El Paso, Las Cruces communities,
Eastern Iowa communities,
Mid-Michigan communities.
We are extremely proud of the quality, balanced journalism that CBS 4 News produces.
But the sharing of biased and false news has become all too common on social media. More alarming, some media outlets publish the same fake stories without checking facts first.
The sharing of biased and false
news has become all too common on social media,
plaguing our country.
And this is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
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 Now, I think you get the point, Martin. I mean, they just go on and on like that for something like another 5 minutes. But the idea really is to warn television viewers, that warn them fake news. They're saying that they're not checking the facts, a lot of these fake news websites. I suppose they're also referring to people like us.
Well, I mean, they would say that, wouldn't they, in the famous words of Mandy Rice Davis. And what's happening is they're creating a psychological state for the majority of the population where they're just being warned off. You don't need to know anything about this. Just ignore this. Go away. Nothing to see here.
I mean, isn't the television creating a sort of a comfort zone where people
be
told, oh, this is, everything's going to be fine, this is all okay.
Yes, that's right, it's all okay. The government's got your best interests at heart. Just keep on taking the pills and do as you're told.
Well, that brings me to the point we made at the top of the hour, which is about Western democracies and how democratic they are.
Well, indeed, and that's a big issue, isn't it? Big question.
Would you like to address this whole idea of oligarchy? What is oligarchy, and can an oligarchy control a democracy?
Well, it can. I mean, it's all actually in Aristotle's Politics, which was written, you know, in the ancient world. Oligarchy and democracy are in constant tension, and they were in ancient Athens. Democracy doesn't lead to a situation where wealthy, powerful people are any less wealthy and powerful than they are in other setups. And the tension between democracy and oligarchy is central to the Western political tradition, and in fact it's central to any kind of politics if you think about it.
Now,
our own mayor
Marvin Rees was on one of these kind of conveyor belts, which I personally don't like them. The idea that you can kind of grab somebody when they're sort of 18-19 years old and say you're going to be a future leader, is that the best way to pick your leaders? I'm not talking about Marvin personally particularly, but this does happen. It happened, for example, with Bill Clinton becoming a Rhodes Scholar when he was a young man.
But also happened with Boris Johnson, who was picked to be a leader before, when he was in his early teens, no doubt, in his own mind.
But he was told at Oxford, you're going to be running the country.
That's right, he was told at Eton. They were all told at Eton, never mind when they went to Oxford. And there's no question, I mean, some people like Bill Clinton and Marvin Rees are picked up from, they're outsiders, and they're picked up and groomed. But some people don't have to be picked up and groomed, like the Rees Moggs and all the rest of it. They're parachuted in, age 15. And they really think that the country does belong to them, and the rest of us are there to do what they think is right.
So when Robin Cook was set to take over the Labour Party, are there ways of stopping people like that actually coming to power? Well, what I'm concerned about is that there are people who would normally rise to the top, someone like John Smith, who was running the Labour Party in the early 1990s, and then we find all of a sudden either they've died, or else for one reason or another they cannot become leader.
Well, there's all sorts of mechanisms by which the oligarchy consolidates its power, including in the United States of America, political assassination. Martin Luther King, John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, all of these people were assassinated. John Lennon, all assassinated supposedly by lone gunmen, load of rubbish. Now, that's the bottom line. And, of course, that's the sort of thing that led the Irish Republican movement to go to war in 1969 in this country, because this country is not immune from that sort of thing either. But the United States is a very violent place run by violent criminals, and so was Russia in the early 90s, less so now. It's probably more a state of laws now than the United States, and it's clearly a more democratic setup. You've got a multi-party system in Russia with two rounds in the presidential election. Putin won overwhelmingly in the first round, with a second place going to Grudinin of the Communist Party on 15% of the vote, the same sort of percentage that Liberal Democrats get here. And if Putin was ever to fall, which he won't, and his party won't fall for a long time, it will be the communists who will be the beneficiaries. And they've got a harder line on things like Salisbury and Duma than Putin. And of course, the people in the West who talk about removing Putin are living in cloud cuckoo land. He's not going to be removed. He may die in office, but then somebody else will take over. The policy won't change because the Russian state has been rebuilt on a strong and fundamentally democratic basis, which is why when they go to World War III against the Americans who can't agree amongst themselves what they want to do, they will win, not just because they're militarily superior.
Okay, how would you rate the democracies here in Britain, in the United States and Israel then?
They are basically oligarchic systems, and the Israelis, of course, use the money that they get from the US taxpayer to influence politics in Britain and in
that's,
the US.
By the way, that's £2.5 to £3 billion a year, isn't it? Equivalent in dollars a year.
Yeah, and if you remember, when Al Jazeera carried out that sting on the Mossad guy at the British...
Shai Massot, the political attaché?
Yeah, he said, well, we're going to spend £1 million in the British Labour Party to get the results we want. So in other words, the Israeli state has spent £1 million inside the Labour Party. Just imagine what they spend inside the Conservative Party.
Well, hang on, he said there's £1 million to be spent. He didn't say it had been spent.
Well, yeah, but it probably has been spent. I'd like to know who got it and what it was spent on. But the fact is, that's what happened.
Okay,
and that's probably, I would put it, Copper's Hunch, Dixon of Dot Green, that's got a lot to do with this anti-Semitism row. Because the Israeli state, using US taxpayer money, is trying to steer British politics in a direction they want to go. And as we said on this show last week, what they want is a war with Iran. And what the ordinary folk in Britain have got to decide is, do we want a war with Iran? Because that's what the Israelis want, and that's what they're pushing for. Do we want it or not? I think it's about time we decided to say no.
Actually, a war with Iran would have all sorts of implications, because it would almost certainly drag in Russia and the United States.
Yeah, it would be World War III. But nevertheless, we're talking about doing it because Trump wants to do it. That's one of the things he'll be talking about when he comes on July the 13th. He'll be bending Theresa's ear and saying, war with Iran, war with Iran. What about it, Theresa? People need to realise this.
I know it sounds like a sort of trite question. In fact, it is a bit of a trite question. But can you rate the democracies in Britain, United States and Israel? Which one is the most democratic? Where do ordinary people get
out
most?
Out of those three?
Yeah.
Out of those three, sadly, it would probably have to be Britain, because in Israel they do have a more democratic PR system, but the Palestinians who are under the boot don't get to vote. Nobody in Gaza gets to vote, do they? And of course, what you could do with a one-state solution, you could have everybody voting in Israel-Palestine, in which the Jewish minority would be represented, but it would be a Palestinian majority. That's already true if you actually analyse the population demographics west of the Jordan. In Britain, we've got a semi-democratic system. It's never been fully democratic. But we've also got a Secret Service that's out of control, a House of Lords that shouldn't really be there.
You mentioned the Secret Service. MI5, with regards to the Shai Massot story, where were they? I mean, that's their job. To stop that sort of thing.
On paper, it's their job to deal with that sort of thing. In actual fact, they're in cahoots with the CIA. The British Secret Services are effectively subcontractors to the CIA and Mossad.
So
that's the reality.
When Amber Rudd was talking about the wonderful anti-terrorist police, I mean, they are in that milieu, MI5...
It strikes me that the Metropolitan Police Anti-Terrorist Squad that took over in Salisbury immediately after this so-called incident occurred are not necessarily to be trusted. And again, I take you back to what happened in 1969 in Ireland, where the Republican movement concluded that the state couldn't be reformed and that something else would have to be done, although they've subsequently changed their minds. But that's the reality. And of course, Britain used to run a big empire all over the world. The British armed forces probably killed up to 110,000 people in camps in Kenya, and mostly tortured to death. And that was in the 1950s. Okay. Nobody was punished for any of it.
Let's run through some more international stories. The US Special Operations troops are secretly fighting the Houthis in Yemen. This story is on antiwar.com. Also, American troops on the Yemen border are ruffling congressional feathers. So the Americans are getting involved there. We just saw that horrific 2 weeks ago drone strike, or was a double tap drone strike, I think, in Yemen, and another one of these wedding parties where the bride was killed by a US or Saudi controlled drone. And then also there was another massive explosion, wasn't there, in Afghanistan, Martin? I mean, we're seeing so many of these enormous attacks, often drone attacks, or they may actually be blamed on suicide bombers but actually carried out by drones. So it's very difficult to know if it's actually a suicide bomber that's done it. There's so much devastation. And I know this was part of the original invasion of Iraq. Local people were saying that it was a drone attack that had killed people, where actually all around the world it was being put out in the media that it was done by a suicide bomber.
Well, what we've got is,
don't forget that Al-Qaeda was set up by the Western intelligence services under Operation Cyclone in the 1980s. And so the idea that the story we're told that Al-Qaeda suddenly broke away from their creators, the Western intelligence services and the Saudis, and set off on their own mission. But that, I'm quite certain that the Russian general staff don't believe a word of that, and they are, of course, right. And that's not because they are evil, it's because they're professional and they can tell what's going on. That, you know, the Russians said there was going to be a false flag chemical weapons attack in Syria before it happened. They said, we are in intel is that you're going to try and do something like this, and they flag it up in advance because they know it's going to happen, because they've got a sufficient professionalism to be able to find out. But the reality is that the Western intelligence services have subverted democracy in the West completely since World War II. Completely. They intervene at every level to steer politics in the direction that the oligarchy wants it to do. And that is the go. And that they're basically answerable to the oligarchy. And the senior managers at MI6, like Dearlove, who said that Corbyn could never be prime minister, he's supposed to be a public servant. But he said, well, Corbyn couldn't possibly be prime minister. It just shows you where they're coming from. They are not answerable to the democratic politicians. They're answerable to their handlers in the oligarchy. But, of course, we've got to have a pretense of democracy. So we have elections, but they're rigged, not by the Russians.
Now, there's been a massive discovery by the, I believe it's the Iranians, could be the Syrians, of an enormous amount of weapons going to Al-Qaeda and the Free Syrian Army from the Israelis. Martin, is this this come as a surprise to you? That's literally yesterday.
Not at all. You'd have thought that the Israelis would be very worried about these Islamic extremists in Syria. But it's
actually Syrian military intelligence that seized weapons and Israeli medicine shipment heading to rebels in northern Homs.
Yeah, that's right. So in other words, the Al-Qaeda terrorists in Syria are not only being winked at by Israel and the West, they're being supplied with weaponry and they're being trained. The SAS are training them. And then they come back to Britain and blow things up.
So we've got special forces in Yemen, actually, and in Syria.
Yeah.
And none of this has been voted
no,
for.
No, and that's not been debated by Parliament and all the rest of it. And of course, we don't comment on what special forces get up to. But of course, it's illegal, all of it. I mean, in actual fact, the US Constitution says that only Congress can declare war. But that's been completely undermined. And now Trump can just press a button and he can bomb somebody or send a tweet saying we're going to bomb you. He's not supposed to do that, but he does.
One of the best points the former Egyptian ambassador from the UK's daughter, Vanessa Beely, made on last week's programme was the fact that so few of the London media journalists are actually holding the standard of international law to what the Western countries are doing in Syria, Libya, Israel and elsewhere.
Well, international law means what we want it to mean. It's an Alice in Wonderland definition as far as they're concerned.
We can't just go and invade a country without getting permission of Parliament, without telling anybody, can we?
Well, we can.
Without the permission of the UN?
We can, and we're doing it. And, of course, you were discussing earlier on the possibility of trying to remove the Russian veto in the Security Council. They're talking about going round it by going to the General Assembly to outvote the Security Council members. But, of course, they never suggest that about Israel. Israel has had a US veto protecting it from various resolutions down the years against what it's been doing. And the US has vetoed. Are they going to allow the General Assembly to vote on that? because I don't think that the Israelis should be in the General Assembly. And I think if the General Assembly were allowed to vote on that, the Israelis might be removed.
Another story. This is yesterday. The Ministry of Defence accidentally reveals that British drones are firing thermobaric missiles in Syria. It would be a bit of embarrassing if one of those hit a load of Russians. The Ministry of Defence has revealed for the first time, seemingly accidentally, that British drones are firing thermobaric weapons in Syria. The disclosure comes in a Freedom of Information response from Drone Wars detailing the use of Reaper drones over the previous 3 months. In the response, officials gave a breakdown of the type of Hellfire missiles fired, stating that 19 AGM 114N4s and 44 AGM 114R2s had been used. The N version of the missile uses a metal augmented charge warhead that contains a thermobaric explosive, which uses aluminium within the explosive mixture. Now, these things, when they go off, they are incredibly nasty. They damage lungs. I think I'm right in saying they're also known as fuel air bombs. What they do is basically asphyxiate anybody in the area, Martin.
Yeah, pretty indiscriminate weapons and far more dangerous than chemical weapons. But hey, what we do is what we do. And what the other side do, we do, you know, it's propaganda of the worst kind that we're being subjected to. And it's very worrying because it means that we're on the brink of a major war and people are sleepwalking into it because they're being told a load of fibs.
Okay, so finally tonight we'll have a listen again to a speech from 1994 by the son of the Jewish lawyer who's the lawyer for the U.S. Jewish boycott of Nazi Germany. His name's Anton Chaitkin, and he has a bit of a downer on the Brits. He thinks the Brits are actually at the heart of a lot of the problems of the world today, not just for creating the United States and creating Israel.
I would propose that the solution to this problem of the end times is not to destroy the world and to destroy mankind, as some people think God wants to do, wrongly, because it's the British Empire that wants to do that, or that wants to talk about that. But rather, that we should do what God did at Sodom and Gomorrah, which is finish off this end times party. The end times party, the people who are preaching the extermination of mankind. This gang, like this guy Baruch Goldstein, like Henry Kissinger, like Lord Carrington, like Lady Thatcher, like George Bush. This is a party. Meyer Lansky Party, the people who set up Hollywood. Hollywood as an institution and this party of gangsters. You have to count the number of bodies, dead bodies, piled up by the hundreds in the establishment of Hollywood and of Las Vegas and of what is being proposed to you for your future by this party. I would say instead that we go back, take a trip to Israel sometime, and you'll see by the Dead Sea, there's a little site, and you may see a sign, like a road sign or what have you, where Sodom and Gomorrah were. Now, if you look down, as the bus comes over the ridge, you look down in the valley next to the Dead Sea, it looks like God smashed up this area real hard. It just looks just like that. It's in the Great Rift Valley. The whole thing was shaken up all the way down to Africa. And in Hebrew, the words are Sodom and Gomorrah, which means closed and finished. And they don't mean the world. They're talking about those guys. We need to finish off this party, to close this party that we're talking about, so that mankind can live.
What's the name of that party?
What's the name of the party?
Spell it.
The British Empire. British, I'll be more specific. British empiricism. Empiricism. That's a very serious question. But what's a way that you can identify this generally? Well, you can identify this in many fields. It's not just a group. It's a way of thinking also. Up until about 1815, Sir Isaac Newton was considered to be a fraud, cheap. He's called an empiricist. That used to be another word for atheism. if you were an empiricist, that meant that you didn't believe, you didn't even pay any attention to any deeper cause of anything than what you saw or perceived with your senses. And so you're obviously a charlatan in science. But after that period, when you have these characters taking over our universities, and you have the proliferation of British Freemasonry and various forms of corruption in culture, you have all kinds of things presented to people as if they were scientific and great, until in the 20th century it becomes totally laughable and people are embarrassed to even talk about these things. For example, Picasso becomes a great artist at a certain point. He actually was a decent second-rate artist at a certain young age, and then he started making these crazy things on the paper and was promoted by these oligarchs, these British characters. It's music the same way. Do you ever hear so-called modern serious music? Completely insane, deliberately insane, deliberately insulting to the human mind, to human emotions, so forth. And they say it as if it were the same category of event as Beethoven. And then, of course, you have the British empiricist line that's drawn that says that science and religion must be always separated from one another, whereas the classical scientists, the ones who made all the great discoveries, were always deeply religious people. So British empiricism, this way of saying that you should take a cheap view of the world. Life is cheap. Labor should be cheap. Don't spend too much time and effort on doing philosophy when you're going to deal with science. Just pick up what the senses say and publish something and kill the scientists who are deeper thinkers or destroy their reputations. That's British empiricism.
And that was Anton Chaitkin speaking in 1994. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 8. Coming up live on Facebook, it's Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi, possibly. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Labour Councillor for St George Troopers Hill, Fabian Breckles. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. We're on thisweek.org.uk. Please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
93.2 online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.